Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Mount Rushmore. It's getting longer and longer, the mouthfuls that I'm going to call things. And we've reached the end of Series 1. So this is the end of Series 1. So Gary, first of all, as the sort of series creator and administrator slash screenplay writer, as I gave Stephen his title the other day, for his End of an Era series, how do you think it's gone, first of all?
Well, you forgot to add sculptor. Obviously, for this.
Sorry, yeah, and sculptor and best audio.
Thank you. Well, yeah, otherwise, it's been great. Really enjoyed the series, had some great guests on, and it's been interesting to hear the criteria that the guys have used to slip their nominations for Mount Rushmore. So, I've been well chuffed with it. It's gone really well.
And this one, this episode to finish off with, how are you feeling about this one?
Local club to me from my time back in the UK, only a few miles away. And I did a bit of research on the club today and some really surprised. Well, I was surprised. That sounds a little bit condescending. I don't mean it to be. But that's some mightily impressive players played for this club who, might not realise.
You're right, actually. It's funny. I was doing exactly the same thing. Well, I was actually at work. I was supposed to be working, but you know how it is.
Nobody's listening.
Exactly. Certainly nobody I work with will. We don't worry about that. Yeah, and you're right. When you sort of have a look, and when we've looked at the main ones we're going to discuss in this episode, and then who actually has also been there, it was quite surprising. Stephen, obviously you've been with us for all of them. How have you found this particular series?
Oh, it's been great. You know, like we said earlier in the series, you know, there's certain positions that you find particularly fascinating to see what era a player's got to be picked from. We'll give nothing away there to Matthew to see if he falls into line with virtually everyone else. But yes, it's been thoroughly enjoyable and it's kept Gary busy in the sculpting.
The good news is we already know who Matthew's picked for our favourite position, Stephen, and it's an absolute blinder.
Indeed.
It is an absolute blinder, this one. Now, clearly, normally we try and keep it a surprise and a secret. I don't know why, because it's plastered right over the tag when you go and click on to listen and watch these. But I would like to introduce the final guest for Series 1, which is Matthew Gibbs. Matthew, welcome.
Hi, hello.
Happy to have the final slot on this series.
Very happy. I get to come on and talk for like an hour about my club. It's what more can you want?
I've got to draw attention to the backdrop. I don't know if you want to educate maybe the uneducated, but maybe the people who aren't quite au fait with kits through the ages of your club.
Well, yeah. So the one over my left shoulder is the Penguin, one of our sort of iconic kits. Like everyone, all Blues fans get a bit excited when there's a Penguin coming along. And this one is from like the 70s, 80s, but like back during that sort of era when we had like a few of the players we're going to talk about today are from that era. Is that when you think of classic Blues teams, you think of this kit. And then this one is an admittedly disgusting kit, but I love it. It's from the original is from the same era. We had this German kit, which is, even though it's in a Belgian flag, we call it the German kit. Who knows? But yeah, it's just sort of a cool top from the 70s, 80s that they did a remake of a couple of years ago. And I was, I guess, lucky enough to get my hands on it. It's not the best, but I like it. It's a lot about what I like about Blues, you know, cult and a little bit different.
Brilliant. I must admit, the one on the right-hand side, as I'm looking at it, is by far my most favourite one out of the two. Not that you even care what I think, but it's definitely the one on my right, your left. So obviously Birmingham City fan. So before we sort of get into your choices and before we get your definitive four players for the club, just a little bit about your history as a fan of Birmingham City.
Yeah, so basically all comes from I'm from Birmingham. I've lived in the city most of my life. Birmingham City fan because of my family. And I think something that like one of my favourite things about being a Blues fan is something that comes with it is this kind of sardonic, self-deprecating sense of humour. It's a kind of, we know we're shit and that's okay, let's laugh about it, approach to football fandom. So we joke a lot about what we've done in our past lives to deserve supporting Blues, but it's just that really, it's just jokes because wouldn't have it any other way. Because our entire history is basically like a pied history of nearly men, almost success. We build these really exciting, really good sides, and then success is sort of hard to come by. And so something we say in this podcast a lot, something we say with these Football Times, is that football reflects society. And that's something I think is especially true about Birmingham City. We're a working class club in a working class area that isn't particularly well looked after. Like Small Heath is where the stadium is. It's not massively well looked after. We're a club that values hard work and endeavour above everything else, to almost to a fault, where we have this inbuilt suspicion of what you might call flair players. Another Blue Nose, Sean Cole, is a journalist, wrote in When Saturday Comes, summed it up perfectly when he points out that one of our regular songs, it's not like an anthem, but it's something we sing a lot at games, is "Get into them, fuck them up." But we don't give fair players a chance for fear they weren't grafted enough. It's all about hard work. So all of our sides are like these industrial workhorse players. And it's like a self-defeating prophecy. It's like we make our own downfall. Like a big reason why we've been bumbling around the divisions for like 145 years. But some things I want to point out. One thing that not many people might know is that we were the first English team to play in Europe, and then the first English team to play in a European final at a time when not many English clubs could really be bothered to. So we played Barcelona in the final of the 1960 Intercities Fairs Cups in 1960. We drew the home leg 0-0, then let it slip a little in the second by losing 4-1. We lost one of the famous FA Cup finals in 1956, which we'll get to later. We got two League Cups to our name, which we'll talk about later as well. But yeah, apart from that, it's a lot of heartache, close calls and genuine anger about what happens. But it's sort of a sense of humour and that ability to laugh in the face of constant failure. It's part of me and it's part of the Birmingham thing. It's part of being a Blues fan. Like, I'm intensely proud of where I'm from. I'm very proud of Birmingham and Blues are they're a big part of that. So, yeah, I love my club and I'm excited to talk about some great footballers.
Brilliant. We're clearly not going to be in this for the humour and the silverware, but that's all right. That's okay. That's irrelevant. When you're a part-time Hull City fan, I can share your pain. Don't worry about that. We haven't even got any. So don't worry about that. Gary, I'll come to you first, obviously. I don't want to say you're a native. I don't want to say the wrong thing when people are from different areas of the city, so I won't say that, but geographically, you've lived the nearest, I think is probably the safest way to say it. So your sort of overarching thoughts before we get into this about Birmingham City.
Yeah, well, I'm not a Brummie. I'm from Walsall, which is quite close. But my daughter married a Brummie, although Matthew won't let me say that the whole family is a Villa family rather than a Birmingham family. But I think that's the one thing about Birmingham, certainly for the vast majority of the time I've sort of been a bit interested in football, is they've been the second club in the second city. And you see in lots of cities like Stevie's, Liverpool and Everton. I mean, Everton have been top dogs for a while. City United, same sort of thing. But Birmingham City have been, I'd say, the second club for, I don't think I'm overstated, for the vast majority of certainly the last sort of 50 years or so. They've won a couple of trophies. And I think that sort of playing record deserves a lot of support. And the supporters who get there, who go to Birmingham regular or even follow them from afar, have developed this very thick-skin, self-deprecating humour that Matthew quite accurately describes. I've got a little story about Birmingham City. Being a Chelsea fan, a little link here. Years ago, before I came out to live in Spain, I used to run a design agency. The design agency was owned by a guy who owned a print company with print partners for Birmingham City. And they used to produce all the programmes and that sort of thing. So we got invited to entertainment at the games. And we also went to the 100th anniversary to the Players of the Year Awards. And one of my all-time heroes, Gianfranco Zola, has been appointed a manager of Birmingham City. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go to the Player of the Year Awards and I'm going to meet Franco. This is going to be brilliant, brilliant. And I said to Anthony, the guy on the company, you've got the tickets, everything's fine, you've got the tickets on the table, it's fine. 2 weeks before the event, they bloody sacked him. That's Birmingham for you.
Brilliant. It's classic.
Never fails to disappoint, even Chelsea fans. That's quite something, that. Stephen, for you, I guess, you know, Birmingham, certainly for me, Birmingham City are a club that always, I always sort of grew up with in my conscience. They were always there and there and thereabouts without ever setting the world alight. But I could tell you their badge, no problem at all, through my Panini sticker collection. I can describe the Birmingham City badge, no problem at all. But considering it's sort of, you know, England's second biggest city, and, you know, you have Villa there and Birmingham City there and West Brom and Wolves. It's a lot like London, but Birmingham City just never seemed to have, and I guess, you know, sort of Matthew explained that at the beginning, but they never quite seemed to hit the heights as a dominant club within Birmingham.
No, they just seem to stall, and whether that's, you know, by just general nature or whether that's a sense of them hitting the self-destruct button, you know, probably a combination of things, really. But they've always had potential, you know, often had potential, you know, even going back to kind of like, yeah, I'm the same as you, you know, it's the Panini album, it's that badge, you know, it's that kiss, you know, as well as the ones that are behind Matthew there. I always remember the Adidas one with the stripes, which I was always envious of any team that had the Adidas kit in those early 1980s. And Birmingham were just a club that were always kind of there. And then, you know, they'd be relegated, but you'd be pretty sure they were going to bounce straight back up. So they were one of those like early staples of my watching of football. You know, a regular presence in the first division during my most impressionable football watching era, when you're absorbing absolutely everything. And they'd have some very significant players amongst that. You know, they'd have a great deal of capability to be able to turn a big team over, yet couldn't put the consistency together for a decent top half of the table finish, or, you know, a decent cup run. And it was always quite perplexing, because you'd feel that there should be more, and clearly there is on certain levels. But yeah, it was always that sense of, you know, not quite fulfilling the potential that they had, you know, in a similar theme to, say, like a Middlesbrough. You know, you'd scratch your head over how they would be able to go decade to decade and think that they're not quite doing what they should be doing. Yet they would still rise here and there and capable of some fantastic football with some very, very good footballs, as Gary said.
I mean, obviously this is, you know, this is sort of your club, Matthew. It's your, you know, these are your choices that are coming up. But when we've done this so far, and to be fair, you know, Gary's, you know, when Gary came up with the series, you know, there was no sort of hard and fast rule as to how you make your selection. It was, you know, it was just left to how people wanted to do it. And as we've gone through this, it's been quite interesting to listen to people's sort of criteria that they've used to select these, you know, these four players. So before we sort of get into your first choice, what was the criteria that you used in order to pick your players?
I wouldn't say I used any particular criteria, because Birmingham City are one of those clubs where there's a few players that sort of stand head and shoulders above everybody else. So definitely two of the players that I've chosen are, there's no question that they are like the legends of the club and they are the greatest players to ever play for us. When it comes to the other positions, I tried to think of like what and who Birmingham is as a club, and tried to sort of choose players that reflect that. But reflects the good and bad about Birmingham City as a club, I think. But I can't say I had that much of a criteria, to be honest, because like I said, there's a few players that just stand like head and shoulders above everybody else.
So I'm guessing then you've gone right through the whole back catalogue of Birmingham City footballers, and no era, no player is sort of out of bounds, I guess.
No, there are when you go back to like the beginning of the 145 year history, there's always certain players at certain periods that stand out. But when you're talking about that, you mentioned a period. I think I can think of what period it is, and I think because it's a bit similar with Blues, because there are certain There are certain sides, like in the 50s and in the 70s, like certain sides that really stand out as they should have been allowed. They should have won something. We had such an absurdly talented bunch of players at certain points. Like in the 50s, that team was incredible. And same in the 70s. Like they were good enough to win something, and it's only through misfortune or through mismanagement or whatever reason that they didn't. Like I said, there was no certain criteria. There were just certain periods of Blues history that really stand out. And I mean, probably a big part of it, as a lot with other people of my age, is like our parents and like our fathers who passed on the football to us. So like when I was a kid, I remember like quite regularly my dad would crack out the VHS tapes and would watch the season reviews from the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. He was a big fan of watching the ones from the 90s, but we were terrible. But there's a lot of memories there, and like I always, so whenever I think of like the best Blues footballers, I think of like the 70s and 80s and these players who I'd spend like hours as a small child watching on VHS. So, it's definitely a big part of it.
Just before we go and get into your first pick, then can I just quickly ask what year was your first game when you started to go and watch them?
I honestly don't remember. My parents, my dad took me down from like a super early age. Like I remember being, apparently my dad likes to tell a story about, we went to a reserve game and Steve Bruce was playing because he was just coming back from injury. And I just shouted, come on, Steve Bruce, as they were walking out. And apparently it was super embarrassing. But I must have been about 4 or 5. So yeah, it's something that my whole family are Blues fans. So it's something I've always like just totally grown up with.
Okay, brilliant. Okay then, so we'll get started then. So we start off with the goalkeeper. So before you sort of give us your goalkeeping choice, were there any other contenders? Was there anybody who came close or perhaps was worthy of attention, shall we say?
No one comes close, really. But one thing that has been consistent through our, especially modern history, is that we've had a string of really good keepers. Like from in my lifetime, just thinking about in my lifetime, we went from having like Ian Bennett, Nico Vassen, who even though we were in the Championship, were really good keepers. From there, we went to Mike Taylor, who is as solid and as dependable a keeper as you can imagine. He put in, there's a game where we lost 1-0 to Manchester City, but it is one of the most extraordinary keeping performances I've ever seen. The man saved everything. It was, yeah, just some incredible saves. And then we've had players like Joe Hart play for us, Ben Foster. We've had some seriously good keepers, but no one really comes close, to be honest.
It's okay. So in that case, then who's your goalkeeping choice? Who's number one on your Mount Rushmore?
So first up is Gil Merrick, who is probably the most influential individual to ever represent the club. He's an East Birmingham boy from Sparkhill, not far from my ends. He grew up as a Blues fan. Who went on to play for the club for 20 years. He signed for the club in 1939, but had to wait a while to get first team action because he was behind the pecking order of his childhood hero, Harry Hibbs. But he still managed to rack up 170 appearances before the Second World War started. Once the fighting ended, he cemented himself as number one for the next decade. Really classy, really studious keeper who like commanded his box. As typical with every Blues team, he was involved in a lot of teams scrapping against relegation and got relegated a few times. But everyone could see like he was a special keeper. And I mentioned before, but like our team of the 50s, when we got promoted back to the top division in 1955, we had a really good team. We had Merrick in goal. We had the late Jeff Hall, Roy Warhurst, Alex Govan, Gordon Astall, Eddie Brown, like really, really good players, good enough to win something. We recorded our highest ever position of 6th in the first division. We were the first team to play in Europe. We drew 0-0 with Internazionale. Then we reached the FA Cup final, where we somehow lost to Manchester City, even though Manchester City had a broken neck to Bert Trautmann in goal. And from that FA Cup run, there's some really fantastic footage on YouTube from British Patho, where you can see how good Merrick is. By this point in time, he'd already been capped 23 times by England. And it's very typical, I think, of Blues, Birmingham City, that our greatest ever servant is remembered as an England failure. Because I found the Guardian obituary of him when he died in 2010. And it basically, the entire obituary focused on him being in goal when England were decimated by the magnificent Magyars of Hungary. 6-3 at Wembley, then 7-1 at the Nep Stadium. And he was in goal for England's exit at the 54 World Cup as well, when we were beaten 4-2 by Uruguay. The independent Obit is a bit nicer. Remember some performances he gave, especially against Austria. But he's remembered as a Birmingham City legend, like a fantastic keeper, our record appearance holder with a mammoth 551 appearances. And one of our stands is named after him. And he was the first inductee into our Hall of Fame. Before I finish, he retired in 1960. So he didn't get to represent Blues at the 1960 Intercity Fairs final, but he wasn't done with the club yet. He then went on to manage us, replacing the outgoing Pat Beasley, and was in charge of us for 4 years. 202 matches, with the two most important matches being the two-legged League Cup final in 1964, where we beat our neighbours Aston Villa 3-1 over two legs. And it's one of only two moments, one of only two real moments of success for us. And it's wonderful that like one of our club legends was there to manage us to victory.
I mean, Gary, it's not a bad opening, to be fair, is it? But as opening goalkeepers, it's not bad.
There's always something special, but it's a local boy. And, I found out this morning that I didn't know that Gilmary came from Spark Hill, which is, as Matt said, is very close to St Andrews anyway. But the goalkeeping position, as Matt said, is one where Birmingham have had so many talented keepers. I mean, in the semi-recent history, I'm 9 international goalkeepers, six went on to represent England, Gilmary, Jack Butland, Ben Foster, Joe Hart, David Seaman played for Birmingham, as did Tony Cote. Tony Cote played for England B. We also had a couple of Welsh internationals, Boris Myhill, and going back a little bit farther, Gary Sprake. And Mike Taylor, as Matt said, the other one notable goalkeeper was the penalty side king from Ipswich Town, Paul Cooper. But Birmingham have had an awful lot of outstanding goalkeepers, for Gilmary to be picked above that, you know, that's some recommendation. But I think Matt's picked the right guy.
It's funny. We've obviously clearly been working together too long. My first note in here to ask one of you is, you can't, as you brought up, Gary. To be fair, as you like we said, geographically the nearest. You're right. That local boy, that local, you know, the child or the kid who makes it. That story, you can't beat it, can you?
No, and I suppose in the modern parlance is, you know, that he's one of our own. Yeah. And, you know, Gilmary was definitely one of Birmingham's own in so many ways,
And I mean, the other thing as well, Gary, I'll throw something at Stephen as well, but that when you think of his career, as Matthew's explained it there, and yet you have, you know, the war years also in that career, and you look at the number of appearances, the duration of a career, you know, and again, it's one of those what could have been. And I know that applies to an awful lot of footballers, well, every footballer of that era. But when you think about the interruption within their careers and what could have been, it speaks volumes.
I mean, as you said, Matt said, over 500 games, you know, you could probably put another 152 on top of that if you take 6 or 7 years, then he was there, you know, didn't have a chance to play. I think you're talking ridiculous numbers, absolutely crazy numbers. But that was the talent of the guy. He was an outstanding goalkeeper, and the reason he played so long was because he was so good.
It's my question for you, Stephen. I'm not quite formulated into a question yet, but I know what I want to ask. Just sometimes there are games where they are iconic games, and you know, and the game shifts. The game it feels like it's a slightly different game once that particular game has finished. And obviously that Hungary versus England 6-3 is one of those games. And you look back over the genesis of the game and when the game shifts and moves, you know, that is one of those games. And to be a goalkeeper, Matt talks about the obituaries and how people are treated by it. But I suppose the question is, you know, as a player, you must feel incredibly privileged to be on the pitch, whether you're the goalkeeper or not. And granted, you would have had the best view by far. But it must have felt, well, I'm not actually, what I'm going to ask you is, how do you think it feels when you share the pitch with a game, in a game that changes literally the game?
I can imagine at the time it probably didn't feel so good.
No.
But I would imagine that the glow of that must have increased year on year. To play in a game like that, that is just an iconic part of football history. You know, there must be, you know, a sense of pride within it. I mean, I know as a football supporter that there's certain games that I've watched my team play, and it's not every one of those being a winning game, where I've got an immense sense of pride that my team played a part in that, and that's just as a supporter. So, you know, as a player, that must be a feeling that is absolutely, you know, 10 or 100 fold of what it feels like as a supporter.
I mean, because one of the reasons why I was thinking about it, I know obviously at time of recording, we're sort of 24 hours into the news of Maradona passing away. But again, I suppose that England quarterfinal in Mexico in 86. And again, like you say, you know, there's devastation of getting knocked out in the quarterfinals. But, you know, you listen to some of the players and you sort of see what's been written about him. And those sort of 11 players that were on the pitch that day that were there for that goal and that performance, both goals, but certainly the second goal and that performance, that there has to be something, like you say, that over time, you almost must take a sense of pride in that I was one of the 11.
Totally. Because I think what you got to look at with that game between Argentina and England is that the certain parts of that England team that maybe not applaud what happened, but they understand what happened. And there's one or two, like Gary Lineker's since turned around and said, you know, if I could have done it, I'd have done it. So you've got those pragmatic parts of that side. But then you've got the militant ones as well. And we all know who they are. But within that, those militant ones, I don't think there's a single one of them at some point that hasn't lauded that second goal. You know, as militant as they are over the first one, you know, I think they've all kind of like applauded and stood up and paid respects to that second goal, which kind of says a lot there. You know, and there has to be that sense of pride to be part of that. And it is. It's a piece of history. It's a moment in time. It's a snapshot image. It's one of those. It's like football's Zapruder moments. You know, they are these static moments that just flash and leave a massive imprint on the mind and the memory. And, you know, for Gil Merrick, within that game against Hungary, you know, he must have carried that as an honour for many, many years.
It's, yeah. As Matthew was talking then, and I was thinking what it must have been like you say, at Wembley on that day. And then obviously, you know, you go to Hungary and the same thing happens again. So, you know, goalkeeper, great choice, Matthew. You know, there's clearly no argument about that. Now, the defenders is one that always entertains, certainly Stephen and I. This is the one we always look forward to. And I don't know why, because it's everything that I don't like about the game, but yet it fascinates me. So, in terms of defenders, before you give us who you picked, again, who were your sort of, you know, who were your front runners, who were your close contenders?
It's again, like, so we've had some, like, because we're a team that's always sort of valued defensive solidity above anything else, really. So we've had some fantastic defenders down the years. We had Roy Warhurst, Trevor Smith, Gary Pendry, Kenny Cunningham, who was more of a modern shout, but he was excellent for us. Joe Gallagher, Malcolm Page. I very nearly went with Jeff Hall, who's one of the stars of that 50s team, along with Merrick. He tragically died of polio while he was playing for us at the age of 29. And his death is credited as the turning point in the fight against polio in Britain. It's a really fascinating and tragic story. But in the end, I went with something slightly different, something from the more iconic side of the 70s.
I think it's a brilliant choice. And again, it's probably a choice that a lot of people won't necessarily associate with your club. But that's by the way, I completely disregard that. Your choice is brilliant. Who is it that you've gone with?
Yeah, so in the end, I chose Kenny Burns. Like you say, he's remembered more as a Nottingham Forest player as part of Brian Clough's squad. But he actually made more appearances for us and he's really fondly remembered down at St Andrews. He's another one of these players that when I was growing up, my dad would mention a lot, and he's always a regular feature on the VHS tapes. He was part of that just insanely talented 70s side that somehow failed to win anything. And they only managed to finish the highest position was 10th. And we had players like Bob Latchford, Bob Hatton, Gordon Taylor, Trevor Francis, Gary Pendry, Paul Hendry, and then Freddie Goodwin as manager, who was interesting manager, if nothing else. Criminal that we only finished as high as 10th. Burns was, he was signed as a centre-half for us at the age of 17. And he was like, because of his heading ability, he really excelled. But I can't lie, I cheated a little with this one because Burns signed with us as a defender. But after Bob Latchford left in 1974, he was converted into a centre forward in the same season, and he ended up winning player of the season. He finished his Blues career with 45 goals and 170 appearances, which for a converted centre half is remarkably decent. And the sort of the big season for this was 76-77, where he bagged 4 goals against Derby, a hat-trick in a really famous 6-2 win against Leicester, which as part of that, he won a sports car after the game. And like the first goal in this game is great. Like Francis whips the ball in and Burns kind of miscontrols it and it sort of flicks up at the near post. And it's even though it's just like really acute angle, he like sort of thunders this header in. It's like a really brutish centre-forward goal that like could only happen in the 70s. He finished that season with 19 goals as a converted centre-half. It's like really sensational stuff. And in that season, he also filled in a few times as centre-half, which is just adds to it. He left to join Forest at the end of that year and was converted back to centre-half with Clough. He's one of these players, he always fondly remembers his time down the Blues and has stated since that even though he won everything there is to be won at Forest, he never really wanted to leave. I always get the feeling that Birmingham City is one of those clubs that kind of gets under your skin. And a lot of former players talk about how much they enjoyed their time with us. And like, they kind of wish they'd won something with us because of this strong connection they had with the fans. And Kenny Burns is one of them.
Gary, not nodding away there, obviously, you know, you'll remember Kenny Burns and his playing days, I guess, at Birmingham and at Forest. Yeah. And like we say, there's absolutely nothing wrong with Matthew taking any liberties here. Like we say, when you go with the criteria, you pick what you want. And if the lad's played in defence, the lad's played in defence, and that'll do for me. But you know, yeah, you know your opinion on Kenny Burns.
Well, you know, I mean centre backs, and it's another one. And there's a consistent theme through these series that the guys we've had on, I think, other than one, have all picked centre-backs. And there's something about a centre-half that sort of seeps into the culture of the fans, that, you know, this is a dependable guy. But this guy not only did that, he also went to the other end and played there and bagged a ridiculous amount of goals as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's other sort of defenders that, excuse me, Matt could have perhaps looked on. He mentioned Steve Bruce, but it's also Matthew Upson, played for Birmingham. Went to Arsenal, and he's also mentioned Malcolm Page and Gary Pendry, who is sort of my sort of era as well. And a former Chelsea player, Marion Melchiot, played for Birmingham as well, but not so well. So I don't think he was probably ever in the running so much. But yeah, I think, you know, no arguments really. Kenny Burns, yeah, that's the right choice.
And obviously, yeah, Stephen, you know what we're going to chat about. That, you know, it's another one of those. That this iconic here, you know, Gary's mentioned that everyone's picked about has picked centre half, but we could also say that everyone's picked centre half. Oh, can you still hear me, guys?
Yeah.
Everyone's picked a centre half that that sort of is old school, is, you know, is a what you class as a proper centre half, you know, a centre half, a back in the day centre half, whatever you want to call it. It's a centre half that essentially you wouldn't want to go and play near.
No, that's it. It's that. That sense of trepidation going anywhere near a certain type of central defender, and these the theme of the players that tend to get picked in this series, you know, are from what you would class as being like the golden age of defending, where it was an art form that was part bathed in natural football and talent and part bathed in thuggery. And Kenny Burns was no shrinking violet whatsoever. And for Brian Clough to pick him up and build his title-winning and European Cup-winning sides around him, essentially, says the lot. You know, and at Birmingham, you know, he was such an integral part. And there's something absolutely wonderful about that conversion of a central defender into a striker. And then back again. I've always had a fascination with those players. Ian Marshall was one. I always remember banging in the goals for several clubs and you know, central defender. Paul Warhurst was another one, central defender. You know, went and scored a load of goals, made himself into a striker that I think he broke into the England squad. I can't remember if he played for England or not, but you know, it's just this utter fascination with this sense that, you know, certain central defenders are just kind of like, you know, a striker in a central defender's body, yet they carry both positions off perfectly. And Kenny Burns was one of those. I remember Kenny Burns as a Nottingham Forest player. I remember him playing for Leeds United and you know, winding his career down that way. And always that sense of awe about him. And there was just a massive kind of, almost a fearful respect, I think, of Kenny Burns for anyone who played against him.
I suppose when you're a twice European Cup winner, I guess you kind of earned the right.
You've earned your respect. Yeah. I think he was a player who earned his respect simply by the manner of his play, and then earned it all over again by what he did, you know, in deeds of medals won. And like I said, you know, it's just such a shame that one of those medals wasn't in a Birmingham City shirt. You know, as romantic as it is that Fulham got to the 1975 FA Cup final, you know, there is a bit of a shame there that it wasn't Birmingham. And, you know, a game against West Ham in that 75 Cup final, you know, with a Francis in there and all of those players, you know, it could have been one of the greats.
Gary, I'm going to ask you one more question as the fully paid up member of the Centre Half Appreciation Society. Do you think the game has changed infinitely from the 70s and so on, and I get that, but do you think that fans of clubs still hark back to maybe they were just like a player like that in their squad still?
I mean, yes, I think they do. And I think this series has just probably illustrated that point. And Matthew was with again today. I mean, we had Paul talk about Brian LeBone. We had Philip Neal of Celtic. You know, people don't pick these players because they pick these players because they're somebody who, you know, earns respect and the affection of the fans. So I think the answer is yes. And, you know, Matt's proved that again today.
So we'll come on to midfield, Matt. And I'm obviously, I don't want to be presumptuous. Your picks, you know, you're the Birmingham City fan, but is this the easiest pick for the midfield?
Yes. It's one of the ones, it's like there's no question really. It's he's just head and he's like, along with Gil Merrick, he's just head and shoulders, just he's Blues.
Is there any point in asking if anybody ran not even close, was there even anybody who you sort of briefly thought of at all?
Not really. I kind of like wouldn't have mind talking about some of like my favourite players, because a lot of my favourite Blues players all tend to be midfielders. But that kind of more obscure, I guess, like, you know, Danny Lazaridis, like Australian winger, amazing. One of my favourite players that played down Blues. Brian Hughes was really classy. When you go back a bit further, like we don't tend to have. It's part of the problem that I've mentioned, that we're a workhorse team. We're a very industrial team, so we don't tend to have these wonderful playmakers that can like pick locks and, you know, play this scintillating football. We never really tend to have that. We've always been more of a battling midfielders, get it to the wingers type team. And so yeah, for that reason, there's no question.
So, like I said, this is going to be no surprise to anybody. With an ounce of knowledge or common sense about the game. But who's your midfielder?
So it's Trevor Francis. And if you ask any Birmingham City fan who the best player to ever play for the club is, there's no doubt and there's no question about it. It's Trevor Francis. He's God amongst Blues fans. Like, easily the most talented and like supremely gifted footballer to ever play for us. Joined as a 16-year-old and made an impact straight away, scored 15 goals in his first 16 games. Even scored 4 in a game against Bolton Wanderers before he even turned 17. He's the kind of talent that today would have been hoovered up by an elite club, which I guess is what happened with Jude Bellingham. But football was obviously different back then. We managed to keep him for 8 years. 8 years of TF, 119 goals in 280 games. He was he's one of these versatile attackers that can play anywhere. You want him as a forward, he can do that. You want him in the number 10 position, he can do that. But I think he really excelled in this sort of inverted winger type role on the left, where he could, you know, attack the fullbacks and cut inside to have a shot. And look, when you watch his highlights on YouTube or somewhere, you can see that he had perfected dropping the shoulder from a really early age. He could send a defender one way and then just jink back the other way and give himself half a yard to cross or shoot. And my favourite quirk of his, is that he always seemed to fall over when shooting. It was never, it's never a dive. It's never like he lost control of the shot. I think it was his technique or something where he always, like, maybe he made sure he put everything into the shot. But honestly, you watch his highlights, all of his efforts involve him falling on the floor. And I think it's like, it's something that a modern coach would stamp out, but it's like a really wonderful quirk of his that I love. And he has this like titanic status that even though I never saw him play, I understand what kind of player he is. He just exists in YouTube clips and VHS tapes for me, but he has this like mythical quality where, well, I guess most club legends of any club do. But he scored so many goals and not all of them are on camera. And I know one of his most famous goals, apparently he scored as a teenager, scored a volley from like the edge of the pitch. So like 40 yards from the goal at the edge of the pitch. And there's no record of it. So you kind of have to imagine it in your head. I think it just kind of adds to the legend. And I think he's kind of a combination of Kenny Burns and Gilmeric in the way that he won everything with Forest as the first million-pound player, but has always spoken of how much he loved the Blues, always spoken about how much he loved the fans. And that connection was so big that there were crowds of 30,000 going to see him when he was 16, just to have a chance of seeing him play. And the same as Merrick, he wasn't finished when he left. He came back as a Blues manager and well, classic Blues fashion. We almost found success, but never did. We had, under his managerialship, we had three heartbreaks in the playoffs in Division Two, like in the to get to the Premier League. And the last season of that, we went to the League Cup final, the Worthington Cup final back then. I went to Cardiff for that game. Can't say I remember much. I was only 8 years old, but I remember being in the stadium and I remember the atmosphere of being there. And we could and maybe should have won that game. Like, we played well, we should have had a penalty, but it wasn't given for us. And sort of the enduring image now is of Francis and Andy Johnson hugging each other and crying after Johnson missed his penalty. He eventually left his role after arguments with the board, but he has never lost that legend status. He's never in question, never will be. He is the legend of Birmingham City.
Again, Gary, you know, well, two things. Obviously, one, you know, the way Matthew, you know, speaks about him there, it's great, isn't it? It's one of the reasons why this series works, because it gives fans chance to sort of almost offload and eulogise about great players. But also, you know, just occasionally on this, you get a player who just is the club. You know, they just are. You just, you know, the minute you say the club, one player springs to mind straight away. And this is a great example of that.
Yeah. I think it's not only the least surprising choice in this episode, it's probably the least surprising choice in the entire series. as you say, you know, you mentioned Trevor Francis and you Birmingham, you mentioned Birmingham, Trevor Francis. Because of where I used to live on Sunday, the highlights programme, which is called Star Soccer in the Midlands, and Hugh Johns was always commentating just to get on my nerves. But so Birmingham were featured a fair bit of time. So I saw a lot of Trevor Francis playing for Birmingham City in those years, and you know, almost all the what seemed outrageous descriptions of his ability were actually true. He was that quick, he was that good, he could beat a player in the city on a sixpence. He scored goals. He always had this sort of like almost a frail looking team. He wasn't a sort of big muscular forward, but yeah, he's an outstanding player. And you know, if you, as I said, you know, if you ask any Birmingham City fan, or almost any Birmingham City fan, you know, their number one choice player of all time, it's going to be Trevor Francis. That's no doubt. I never actually saw him play in live for Birmingham. I saw him play for Forest at the Wolves many years ago when he'd gone to Forest. And I think he was playing for Gary Birtles at the time. And he was one of these players, and it put me in my little bit of mind of Ryan Giggs. When he ran, he looked like his feet weren't actually touching the ground. He was a bit sort of like, but he touched almost hovered above the ground. It seems stupid to say it, but he's got that grace and elegance about him as well as the ability. So, fantastic player.
Stephen, first of all, Matthew is probably, and most Birmingham City fans must be quite angry that Brian Clough essentially has swallowed up 50% of Matthew's choices. Or in fact, he's swallowed up 66% as it stands at the moment. And sort of taking them to sort of European Cup glory. But yet it's strange that Kenny Burns is this association with Forest, and yet Trevor Francis has this association with Birmingham, and yet they're not identical, but It's the same route. It's the same travelled route. The success was obtained at the same club. And yet you have two completely different associations with those two players.
Yeah, Francis is quite unique in that respect, is that no matter what he went to do after Birmingham City, and, you know, win a European Cup with Nottingham Forest, go and play in Serie A, you know, all of this is, you know, amazing stuff that he went on to do. Yet he's still most closely associated with Birmingham City. And it's that breakthrough at such a young age, at 16. You know, he spent nearly a decade in Birmingham's first team in that respect, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. You know, the most significant part of his career, yet still left at a reasonable age. He wasn't quite 25 when he moved on to Forest. You know, I think the only amazing thing about Trevor Francis is that he never went back to play for them again. You know, if you could have suggested a player will go off and, you know, do his travelling, you know, go and play elsewhere, win that European Cup for Forest, go and play in Italy, you'd have swore he'd have been back at St Andrews eventually as a player. You know, that never happened, but he returned as a manager. And he is just so synonymous with them. You know, he is Birmingham City, as Matthew said. You know, there is no other player quite like him. And, you know, I think he played... There's an argument to be made to say that he played, no matter what he did after Birmingham City, that his best football was played in a Birmingham City shirt. You know, his list of honours and achievements grew after he left Birmingham City. Yet his finest football was played for them.
I mean, obviously, I say, you know, just coming back to you, Matthew. You know, he is, as Gary probably summed it up really well there, he's probably the easiest pick that any guest has had on any of these episodes so far.
It is. It's like there's no question, and it's there is an element, I think, for me anyway. I'm not, because I never saw him play, and so maybe it's different for like my dad and his generation. But for me, there's always an element of like frustration, because, like you say, like Forest picked up like Burns and Francis from us and went on to win like everything. So there was this ability there. It just could not be harnessed into, you know, creating like a team that could do anything apart from finish 10th. It's sort of like, it's classic Blues. It's classic of a club that I don't want to say that we are like, I don't think we're hated in Britain. I just think we're not thought about very often. So it's quite frustrating then that even our best players are kind of associated with other clubs. But I've written about Trevor Francis for these whole times, and I actually asked the Forest fan, like, where does he stand with Forest fans? And they're like, yeah, we like him, but he's not a legend. And speaking as a Birmingham City fan, it's something that I can't quite comprehend. He holds such a huge status for us that, like, and well, it's such a huge status for us, and he scored the goal that won them like the Champions League. Like, you'd think that he would have a similar sort of, you know, similar status over there, but no. And it's just, I know, there's something quite eternally frustrating about it, to be honest.
But I suppose, to come back to that then, just before we move on, but does that give you a sense of satisfaction that you can reclaim him back as your own now? You don't have to share him with anyone.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I guess there is a certain sort of, like, you know, when you're playing with like your younger brother or something, you're like, no, it's my toy. Yeah, like, yeah, he's our player. But yeah, no, there is something there, but it's mostly just kind of frustration that, one, we never won anything with these amazing players in our team. Like, that 70s team is absurdly talented. Like, how that could not be fashioned into something that was challenging like the top four or challenging the top of the table. In hindsight, I can't comprehend. But yeah, also frustration that, like, our best players are associated with other clubs.
I mean, we're working our way forward, but, you know, I guess we come now to the sort of the sharp end of the selection with your strikers. This one a bit more difficult?
Not really. We've had some very good strikers down the years. But I think I went with a bit more of a controversial pick with this, because when you were talking about criteria earlier, maybe this is the one where I thought there is a left field choice that kind of sums the club up. Like, I've spoken about how much I adore the city and how much I adore my club, but I'm well aware of what we are and where we are as a club. And that's something that I think Blues fans, we never lose sight of. We never lose our perspective. Maybe that's why our anthem is all about like long, never-ending roads. But I understand that we're a smallish club, a club that is not really thought about by the rest of the country. We're a club that attracts problems. It's kind of always under the radar, but we attract problems. And those problems usually come in the form of terrible owners. So for like a long time, we've been a really badly run club. We went from the Kumar brothers in the 90s who nearly bankrupt us to Sullivan, Gold and Brady, who basically used us as training wheels for that ultimate goal of earning West Ham, to Carson Young, who bought us with £80 million of laundered money and was thrown into jail in Hong Kong, and then now to whoever owns us now, which isn't entirely clear. So I talked a lot about flair players, but I included two classy footballers in Francis and Merrick. So I wanted to pick someone who sort of reflects how poorly run a club we are, reflects how, you know, the history of Birmingham is a long line of poor decisions, but then has also been there for like some of our proudest moments.
Okay, but that is a unique, I'm not going to lie, that's the most unique criteria we've also ever had.
Well,
I guess before your choice then, I'm still not really sure like how you've arrived at the choice you have, but is there anybody who came close other than this final choice?
Yeah, there's tons. We had so many good forwards. We had Bob Patton, Bob Latchford, Joe Bradford, who is our like all-time record goal scorer. There's the more obvious choice, who I'm sure Blues fans are going to be screaming at me of not mentioning, Christophe Dugarry. It kind of hurt not picking Zizika over Dugarry, because he's without doubt the most stylish footballer I've ever seen with my own eyes, like just oozing technique, like commanding the pitch when he's on it. Like I knew at the time when we signed him that it was a big deal, but every year on year, it sort of dawns on me even more how absurd this deal was, that we managed to sign like a European Championship winner and World Cup winner for Blues. Like, we've only ever signed one World Cup winner in our history, which was Tarantini back in the 80s. I've written about this before for No Place Like Home magazine, but like, Dugarry's time with Blues, I think, perfectly captures why we like football. It's these kind of stories, you know, a disgustingly talented player winning over this working class crowd with these abilities we're not used to seeing, like his goal against Charlton, his performance against Southampton. Like, it was short. He was with us for like less than a year, but it doesn't matter, man. It doesn't matter we'll never win the Champions League because we have moments like this and like players like Dugarry.
Brilliant. I love it when people speak like this. So your choice then, who have you actually gone with?
Possibly regretting this now, but I went with the kind of cult figure of Nikola Zizek. He is this huge 6'4" lanky giant from Serbia. He is the epitome of a target man, had the turning circle of a freight train, and was publicly admonished by Lee Clark, of all people, for apparently putting in no effort in training. But we kind of love him. Like, he has this cult status, which is maybe no surprise since he's been involved with like two or three of the most important goals in our history. So he scored the winner in the League Cup quarterfinal in 2011 against Aston Villa. It's one of those games where I couldn't tell you if it was a good game or not, but it's one of my favourite games I've ever been to, and largely because of his scuffed finish in the last minute of the game. He then scored in the League Cup final when we somehow beat Arsenal. Seb Larsson puts this really flat corner in that gets headed on by Roger Johnson. Zizek twists himself to like touch it past Szczesny. And then he was involved with the winner, knocking the ball down for Szczesny and Koscielny to make a mess of. And Abafemi Martin's open goal wins a cup for us. I screamed myself dizzy. I'd never experienced joy like it, to be honest. A few years later, we're 2-0 down at the Reebok. Minutes left on the clock. We've had an awful season playing some of the worst football you will ever see, using something like 40 players in the process. We deserve to go down from the Championship, and we're on the brink. But then on the left, Mitch Hancock's puts a cross in and Nikola Zizek attacks it and cushions this perfect header past the bottom keeper. Then he's involved again. Last minute of the game, Jordan Ibe cuts into the box, has an effort. There's a scramble and the ball pops up and Zizek powers his header, cleared off the line, but straight to Paul Caddis, who nods it in and saves us. And I can't stress, like, that game against Bolton was so pivotal. Because of Carson Young being imprisoned, we were hemorrhaging money. I think even at that point, we were owned by the Hong Kong police. Like, there's no one in charge. If we go down, it would break the club in a way that, like, it's possible to recover from. We're all worried that relegation happens then and we go into administration. We get plunged down into, like, the amateur leagues, and we'll be supporting a Phoenix club in a couple of years. And we were that close to annihilation. But Zizek was there. And he was there for so many of our important, like, moments in the last 10 years. But And that is the thing. He's, I think, why I chose him, because he reflects the club. He was signed on these huge 50, 60 grand a month wages with no relegation clause. Another sign of like the ineptitude of people who run us. But so when we were relegated from the Premier League in 2011, he's a major reason why we bleed money so badly. Like the first season wasn't too bad. Like we got to the playoffs, we had a European adventure. But then the season after, that's when things got bad. He refused to take a pay cut, despite the severity of the situation, refused to leave the club. So we're stuck paying these huge wages for a player who didn't want to be there. He wasn't playing well, wasn't training well. And like, if he'd have left, it would have been huge for the club, would have saved so much money. And he's an example of how not to use a player, which is something that always bugs me. Because let's get this straight. Like at this level of football, there are no bad footballers, really. Things might not work out for whatever reason, but everyone at this level, like whether it's Championship League 1, League 2, is a good footballer who has ability. And so did Zizek. He had a remarkable scoring record before joining us, before joining Valencia, who we signed him from. When you used him properly, he was unstoppable. You don't lump balls at him like we did in his later years. You get your wingers to go to the byline, cut it back, have him attack it. No one can stop him when you do that. In this one game under Chris Hughton, he scored 4 goals in a game against Leeds United. All of them were our players getting to the byline and cutting it back for him to attack. So that's why I've chosen him. He represents so much that is good and bad about Blues, like for better and worse. And despite all the sort of problems, I kind of miss seeing him bumble around the pitch while me and every other Blues fan in the Tilton scream at the team and scream at the manager. And he's another example of when I said the club gets under your skin. On his last ever appearance at the club, there was someone took a video of him just sort of slowly walking around the pitch. Because by the end, he'd fallen in love with the club, and kind of we'd fall in love with him. And it's this beautiful moment of him walking around the pitch with his kids, really slowly, like tears coming down his face. And it's kind of a sign about how, you know, you can love a footballer for all his flaws and they can love you back. And yeah, it's just for better or for worse, that's, I think, he represents the club in a lot of ways.
Gary, I don't have a question for you other than what's been to that.
Well, it's interesting because first I want to say there's a few other options that I'm sure Matthew considered. Emil Heskey played for Birmingham. Andy Johnson, we've already touched on. Chris Sutton, Jeff Horsfield, for lots of reasons, as a legend at the club. Mikel Forsell as well, perhaps. But Zizek was an interesting player. One thing I mentioned earlier about going to the Birmingham sort of corporate do thing, and a few of the old players were there. But Zizek was there, I think we went to 3, and Zizek was there every time. And they had these charity auctions, you know, for a box at the ground or a shirt or whatever. Zizek twice bid £1,000 in the charity thing. You know, the bidding was £150, £175, £200. Twice Zizek bid £1,000. So, when Matt says that... He had an affection for the club, had a love for the club. The club were on your skin. Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't know where he actually came in from. He flew from Serbia or where he lived. But he turned up every time I was there. So I'm massively impressed by that. But I'll tell you what, he's a big guy. I mean, I'm quite tall. I'm 6'2", but he towered over me. He's a big guy. So you can imagine him, you know, scoring the goals that Matthew described. But I was impressed by Zizek, I'll say, doing those things. It's a good choice. It's a good choice. I might have gone for Dugarry, I had to say. Dugarry was an outstanding player. Wonderful, wonderful talent. And, you know, as Matthew said, Birmingham had him for about a year or so. But he gave him some wonderful memories. I wrote an article about him a while ago, and I was looking at some of the old YouTube. But I tell you what, this guy had some talent. This guy had plenty of talent.
It's funny, Steve, because we sort of started off, we started at the beginning, you know, talking about, you know, there's nothing better than a local lad and the lad who sort of breaks through and, you know, as Gary said, he's one of our own. But conversely, there's also something about the cult player and the player that you can't quite put your finger on and the player who makes you tear your hair out but also makes you scream yourself hoarse and probably gives you the greatest moment, you know, as a fan. And it's those two, they're almost sort of diametrically opposed and yet both can, and maybe it's the nature of sport or the nature of football, that they can bring the same emotion out in people, but yet be two incredibly contrasting figures.
Oh, completely. The cult hero is just something to be, you know, embraced massively. You know, it's there's never any particular sense over who that is as well. You know, that it's just that player that just I don't know, loses himself in the game almost. You know, they come along and it's almost like they're a law unto themselves, but then they pluck out a piece of genius. It's like Matthew said, you know, his standoff with the club over his contract. Yet something like that will be utterly forgiven at the concept of him, you know, throwing £1,000 down on the table for a charity auction. You know, and then that wondrous kind of like, you know, salvo at the end of the Birmingham, the Bolton game that means so much. You know, cult heroes tend to be very complex. And, you know, it's that fact that they're such of a maverick. And if you're a maverick, you know, you're not following football in a textbook manner. You're just making it up as you go along. You're just following your own path, your own stream, and you know, the rule book just thrown out of the window. And there's something wonderful about that, because there's almost like an innocence about it. You know, it's you know, we can go back to Diego Maradona here, and it's the concept of playing for the joy of it and the love of it. And this is what these players do. You know, the pretenses all fall away. It's almost like they go onto the pitch, and as soon as they step foot over that line, whatever the manager said in the dressing room is completely gone by the wayside, and they're just going to follow their own, you know, play to their own tune. And I think there's just something epically wonderful about that. And I will never, ever disagree with anyone picking a cult hero in this.
I mean, you know, Matthew, these have been your choices, you know, and I guess, you know, the guys have had their say on all the players and all the picks. But are you sort of, you know, from the cult hero to the local boy to the club icon to the converted centre half, you know, and anything you sort of want to add to your choices?
Firstly, I think that's the first time that Zizek has ever been compared to Maradona.
anything is possible.
Anything's possible. No, just to add again, like Zizek example, for example, like it's kind of difficult to not pick as well someone who scored in like one of the biggest moments we've had in our history. Like beating Arsenal in 2011 is it's difficult to put into words like how much that means to Blues fans and how much that was, how huge a moment that was. And like it's something like I will never forget, and like it will always make me smile. Like when you look back and you know look back at the highlights, or every year we celebrate Obafemi Day when in February when he scored that goal. It's difficult to not pick someone like that. And I think something to add as well about the strikers, and you mentioned about the foreign strikers. We had a history, and this is something I'm like eternally fascinated with, because I don't think we're the only club that's done this. But after Duguri came in and had this wonderful salvo and like not single-handedly rescued us from relegation, but something close. There was a string after that of we kept bringing in foreign forwards in January to try and make an impact. So we had Walter Pandiani, who came in and scored some goals. We had Mauro Zarate, who I think not many people know played for us as well. We had Yuri Yarasik, who came in. He was attacking mid, but was brought in to like score some goals. And there's a few, there's like a bit of a trend of foreign footballers that either would come over and would sort of, you know, try and stage a one-man rescue mission. I think Zizek was supposed to be part of that, supposed to be somebody to inspire the team. He was just a bit of a lump, but in a good way. And yeah, no, just to say again, like I know Zizek was a bit of a controversial choice, but I think he represents a lot of good and bad about the club, and a lot of, you know, stuff. Like I love my club, and I think that comes across. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff, even though it sucks, I kind of wouldn't change it.
the final question that we normally ask, and this has got to be the most nailed on answer going, but if you sort of had to pick a Mr. Birmingham City, you know, you've given us four names and they are four completely different sort of, you know, you talked about criteria, it was a very generic criteria, which, you know, which made this so interesting, but if you sort of had to nail your colours to the mast and pick the ultimate sort of Mr. Birmingham City, you know, who are you going to pick?
It would be Trevor Francis. He sort of, you know, for a lot of people, a lot of Blues fans, represents a lot of why he's so good about the club. And a lot of people, excuse me, will talk about, you know, going down to the terraces to watch him play. I mean, again, like just some of the figures I mentioned earlier, like when he was 16, he was so good. he was bringing in crowds of 30,000 people who wanted to see him play, which is scary and amazing and just, yeah, kind of sums up a lot about Blues fans and a lot about the club.
It's, I mean, Gary, it's been, you know, it's been a great way to end the series. It's, you know, and this is no disrespect to the club or to Matthew, but it's, you know, it's not a club that would instantly spring to mind for such a series. And yet, you know, this has probably been the most fascinating, passionate, sort of varied episode that we've probably had.
Yeah, and it just shows that, you know, it doesn't matter whether your clubs are European champions or champions of the solar system like Stevie's lot, or you know, they're a struggling fourth division team or whatever. Every club has its heroes, and you know, every fan has a right to choose those heroes and laud them and explain why. And it almost doesn't matter the level of play at, and you know, Birmingham won trophies, but the, you know, we spoke about Wrexham in a previous episode, and it doesn't match the level of playing at. It's important that you know, players are honoured, and you know, when they give service to a club, that's right. It should be. And I'm really pleased actually that I'm going to be nipping back across to the UK. I've got an exemption on the quarantine regulations, as long as I wear my mask, which is fine. I've got my mask. To chisel in that mountain behind the Gilman stand, and if you know where it is, Matt, well, I'm going to put the faces on for you. I thought it'd be appropriate beyond the Gilmerick stand, you know, because he's going to be one of the faces on there. So I'm not popping to see my family while I'm over there as well. So yeah, thanks for bringing Birmingham on, Matt.
like we say, you know, another. It's great talking about football, but also just sometimes it's great to listen to other people talk about football.
Completely, it's that passion that floods through. That's no matter what the team or the player, you know, it's a common theme amongst this, and it really does just flood through. And it's great to see that passion. You know, we've seen it from all ages, really. You know, of the TFT spectrum. You know, from the oldies like Paul McParlan to the youngest. You know, like James Kelly with Wrexham. You know, it's just that way that it's almost like back on the playground. You know, these are the great players, and let me show you flicking through the Panini album and pointing out your favourites. You know, it's just the way it comes flooding through, and it's great to see.
It's, I mean, I have to say, one of the other compliments to pay you, Matt, is listening to you speak has actually given me an idea for another series, but I'll chat about that later. But it was just right in the middle of. It was while you were in the middle of the last one, and I was listening to you speak, and I was like, oh my God, we could do something here. Not a really good idea. I've just had an idea, and I've just boxed it off and given it the title now. But it has been absolutely brilliant to listen to you.
Ah, thank you very much. I should mention, I need to mention an honourable mention as well. Someone I should have mentioned before, but I think it's really important to talk about Karen Carney. She's the first woman to be inducted into our Blues Hall of Fame. Scored in the Women's FA Cup final in 2012, which we then won on penalties. She's the second highest cap holder for England. Also reached the semis of the Champions League with Blues, which is, you know, amazing, all while being a lifelong Blue Nose. And she's another one where we could spend an entire like podcast talking about her achievements and what she means to the city. But it's just it's what we mentioned before about, you know, how much it means to like how much clubs mean to people, how much playing for your hometown club means, and that passion that comes with it. And now I'm very happy to come on and talk about Blues for an hour. Thanks very much.
Well, like I say, the pleasure certainly was mine. Like I say, to listen, I always get the best spot in these because I just get to listen to you guys chat. And if there's anything I want to know, I'll just throw it out as a question, and somebody will answer me. it's been brilliant. I think it's been a perfect way to end the series. And I'm off to go onto YouTube and start looking at some of the Birmingham City highlights and players that you've mentioned, and just get myself down a little Brummie Warren hole, I think, is where I'm going for the next hour or so.
It was amazing.
Gary, happy with the series?
It's been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant, mate. And, you know, as Stevie said, we've had young fans on, we've had medium-age fans, and we've had even people as old as me on here. And we've had a variety of clubs, a variety of players, and a variety of criteria for the choice as well. So I've been overwhelmed by it. Immense, massively impressed. And I've got to go and buy myself new chisels afterwards as well because I bought them.
Well, see, that's the next thing, because obviously the last big question is, are we going to get commissioned for a second series?
I feel a bit like Alan Partridge at these sort of things, you know. Can I get a second series? Can I get a second series? We'll have to see what the reaction is when they go out live. But, you know, for me, yeah, it's been great. And I'd love to do another series of it because, as Stevie said, it's wonderful to hear people talk about their team and the players that they're really taking to their hearts. It's fascinating to listen to. So I can't see a reason why not, can you?
No, not at all. With that in mind, then, I'm gonna put it out there and say, please join us again next time for the second series of Mount Rushmore, and we'll just see what happens. We'll never know, will we? Matt, thank you ever so much. Steve, thank you, and Gary, brilliant series. Like I said, please join us again next time, even if there is or there isn't a series on a different series. thanks a lot, and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a Thees Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.